Welcome, everybody, to the Aaron's High Cap Adventure Radio program. Today is October 8th, 2016, and we're here live for the next 2 hours, give or take a minute or two. And I'm excited to be here. I'm always excited to be here, and I always say that I'm always excited to be here for one main reason, because I'm very excited to be here. There's just so much information that I wish I could give out, but even with 2 hours, it's like impossible. So many things going on when it comes to politics, when it comes to weather. Have you seen my name on the headlines? Hurricane Matthew is causing problems down there. So we want to pray for all those people down there. Seriously, not just a catchphrase. I'm praying for you. No, in your prayers, ask the good Lord to take care of those people, give them guidance, direction, help, and hopefully a tall, thick, impenetrable hedge of protection somehow to protect them from the devastations of that hurricane and life in general. But ladies and gentlemen, we've got a lot of things going on in the show. This is going to be a very thorough show on the particular topic of preparing. You're going to find it very interesting. So I highly recommend that you stop what you're doing, pay attention to me, and learn a lot. During the course of the week and my life, as always, it's become tradition here. Every opening of the show, I give you my opinion piece. This week is no different. The title of this opinion piece is Preparing for Life. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we've been preparing for things all our lives. We prepare for sports by training physically and mentally. We train or practice or study for tests. We practice and rehearse for job interviews. Whatever it is we are interested in or need to do or get done, we prepare for. But what about for life? And I don't mean the course of life. I mean life, surviving, existence, breathing. Do we prepare for that? We live in a country that allows us almost anything we want if we put our minds to it. But all that prosperity can make us soft or forgetful to the unexpected harshnesses of life. Some of us forget that, but many of us are just plain ignorant to the thought that anything bad could happen to us. With cell phones and McDonald's on every corner, the false illusion of immediate help can take over our common sense. But when a person awakens to the necessity of preparing, it can be somewhat of a traumatic experience. Let me explain. There is a cycle which a person goes through when they realize that they've been a sitting duck when it comes to the harshnesses of life. By the grace of God, they've been spared. Once they realize they are totally behind the curve, they go to hyper mode to catch up. Now, let me tell you the different stages of newly awakened preppers. Number one, first, they are just plain ignorant to the fact that anything serious can happen to them. Two, then for some reason or somehow, they open their minds to realize they're a sitting duck. Then, the next stage is panic. Oh my gosh, I'm nowhere as ready to be prepared. They now fall into the catch-up mode. And I'm not talking the stuff you put on hamburgers either. I'm talking catching up. And buy everything they can as fast as they can and think no matter what they do is just not enough. The next stage, stage five, is the best. This is the burnout stage. This is when the person realizes they can only do what they can do in the means in which they can do it. This includes a short time span of doing nothing further. How are we doing, Dre? Resting the brain, the anxiety, and the stress. Okay? Then comes stage six. Now, I would call that equal to stage five because stage six is just as important as stage five. Stage six is balance. The understanding that life is unpredictable. But because we are aware of that and we have a plan in place, we can, in most cases, ride out the storm. Ladies and gentlemen, the United States is not like it was just 20 years ago. The problems of the world that were outside our borders in other areas of the world are now here. If you're not preparing for the high likelihood of turmoil, you're nuts. You're absolutely nuts. Hurry up and get to stage six as quickly as you can. And remember this. When the stuff hits the fan and you're not prepared, and you go to your neighbor who is, they will look at you with disdain. You have just become an unnecessary and unwanted burden for the rest of us. Become a pillar in your community and teach others to do the same thing. Being hungry, cold, and tired is not fun. Being prepared, fed, secure, and warm is better. Choose which one you want before it's too late. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not kidding you. Get yourself prepared. You see what's happening with Hurricane Matthew. I remember the hurricanes that hit up in New York. People were stranded there just waiting. They're begging for government to come help them. Well, they had plenty of time, plenty of notice to get themselves prepared. Get yourself prepared. You never know what's going to hit. Look at Texas. Texas gets hit all the time with hurricanes. And a lot of the times, you know, Houston, they're running up from Houston. So anything can happen. Be prepared. It's not going to happen to me. Well, you wait. One day it's going to happen and you're going to be gnashing your teeth. All right, let's move on to our show highlights. First of all, if you want to be a part of the show, the number here in the studio is 254-697-6633. Feel free to give us a call. Give all your complaints to Trey today. I'll take all the good stuff. Trey, you prepared? I have a feeling you're going to get some calls. If you want to send me an email, it's aaronsgunshop@gmail.com. And don't forget to go to the website, aaronsgunshop.com, and check out all the little things that we're doing there. We've got a class as well, the license to carry class today at 2 o'clock. There is still room in the class. It's $60 for the class. And anybody wants to take a refresher, it's $40. So give us a call, and we'll get you squared away. Now, today's license to carry segment will cover reckless injury of an innocent third person. Ladies and gentlemen, every round you fire has an attorney attached to it and a stopping point. Make sure yours go where they're supposed to. My NRA section will again go over true stories from the American Rifleman's The Armed Citizens column. Now, I've got four today, and they will prove to be very informative, so get ready for those. In my pep section, I want to talk to you about confidence when you're going to sleep at night. Are you sleeping securely or with one eye open? Today's topic of interest section, sponsored by WRBSales.com, will go over three basic places and methods of holstering a weapon to your body. WRBSales.com has almost anything you can imagine when it comes to this, so go check them out at WRBSales.com. My product spotlight, sponsored by ANC Firearms and Heidenhammer, will be the 1911 auto pistol. I eat, sleep, and drink 1911s. They are a fantastic firearm. You need one. So call ANC Firearms now at 254-983-4417 to get yours today. In my gun training demo, I will explain trigger pull and trigger reset, two vital aspects when choosing a handgun. And that's where the 1911 comes into play. It's incredible when it comes to those two aspects of the trigger. Once again, Cameron Police Chief Randy Dixon, our very own voice of law enforcement, will be talking with us around 11 o'clock. And the chief's a walking encyclopedia of information. Everyone loves the chief and what he has to say. So stay tuned for that. We'll see what he's got to say today. Now, being a prepper show of sorts, it's only befitting to have people on who train in that line of work. So my special guest today will be a former member of Homeland Security for Bell County. Now, I've got lots of questions to ask, and feel free to call in if you have some questions as well. And I'm sure we're going to have a little roundtable here with the chief and our guest and Trey and myself. And we'll be asking some questions here. Hopefully we can all understand better the purposes of Homeland Security and all the other alphabets agencies. So without further delay, everybody, let's start the show officially here. And we're going to go into our license to carry segment. And as I stated in the highlights, we're going to be going over reckless injury of an innocent third person. Excuse me. Reckless injury of an innocent third person. Now, let me read to you the legalese jargon here of this section, and then I want to talk to you about it. Texas Penal Code 905, reckless injury of an innocent third person. Even though an actor is justified under this chapter in threatening or using force or deadly force against another, if in doing so he also recklessly injures or kills an innocent third person, the justification afforded by this chapter is unavailable in the prosecution for reckless injury of a killing of an innocent third person. Huh? Did you catch that, Trey? Basically, here's what it says. Let me give you some examples. look, a lot of people want to protect people. That's just in their nature to protect, protect, protect. Okay. You see somebody else being harmed, you want to protect them. And that's honorable. But we got to be smart about it too. We've got to evaluate the situation. We've got to look upon it. First of all, you got to know your skills. You got to know your mindset, and you've got to know your ability, your skill with a firearm, if that's the method you choose to defend yourself or a third person. Okay? In a picture-perfect world, bad guy's about to do something drastic to an innocent victim, and here you are, and you take the shot, everything's hunky-dory fine. Okay? Perfect world. A perfect world would be just say, hey, stop, don't do that, and the guy goes away or whatever. But let me give you two examples here. Let me give you an example of a good way and a bad way of defending a third person to give you an illustration as to the good way to do it and the bad way. So here you have a situation. Let's say you are facing a commotion and the person's 7 to 10 feet away from you. And the bad person you've identified, but there happens to be a bunch of good people around. And you decide it is necessary to take the shot. You made that decision based on all the elements around you, based on everything that you know. You've made the decision that it's time for me to take the shot. And you take the shot, and it's a good shot. It's a clean shot in the sense of it went where you wanted it to go. But for some reason, the projectile, that bullet that just came out of your gun, goes into the threat and bounces off some bone in the body and comes back out and hits a person who's standing nearby, let's just say in the cheek or the eye or the face or whatever. Okay. I'm not an attorney and I can't tell you what's going to happen in court. But I can tell you common sense-wise, if I'm on a jury or something and I've got to make a decision, if an individual is defending a third person and makes a clean shot, has shown themselves to be proficient, the shot's clean, a projectile, ladies and gentlemen, has a mind of its own. It does whatever it wants to if it hits something. There's no telling what a bullet is going to do once it hits something, okay? So if the shot's clean, it goes in where you intended it to go, but it bounces off a bone and comes back out and hits somebody on the side. Would you consider that reckless? Trey, let me ask you. You're not an attorney. I just want your opinion. If you're the threat and I take a shot dead center mass of you, it goes in, hits a bone, bounces out, but the person who I'm trying to protect, let's say, is over here to your right and the bullet bounces out, hits them in the face. Am I reckless in your opinion?
Well, I don't think you had a reasonable expectation that that would that the round would reflect or deflect off of a bone. You kind of expect when you shoot someone the bullet to stay in them.
Okay, so the shot was true. It was clean in the sense of where it was going. Now, let's do this other illustration. Same scenario. I'm looking at you. I know my abilities, capabilities, so on and so forth. Okay, whatever they may be. And you're the threat, and they'll say there's 5 or 10 people behind you. And my capabilities, whoever this person is, their capabilities are not what they think they are. That's why I always ask the question in your mind, what do you think you are? So I can see what your physical abilities are. Does your physical ability match your mental capacity? You're standing there and all of a sudden I'm freaking out, pull out my gun because I'm going to save the day. And I shoot 10 rounds out of my Glock 17 and I have 10 hit people, all of which are not you. Okay. Because I'm going bam, 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 bam. Is that reckless injury?
Well, yeah.
Okay, now you see the contrast between the two.
Oh, yeah.
Here I take a clean shot. So the first shot enters you where I want it to, but it bounces on a bone, hits somebody in the face. In your opinion, do you think that I am reckless?
No.
I would think that too. I would say, no, not reckless. Now, am I liable? Yes, it's my bullet. So I may be civilly liable, in my opinion, because I'm not an attorney, I can't give you advice, but most likely would be criminal or
civil.
Civil. Okay. So there's the difference between the two. And how do you avoid becoming reckless?
Training.
Take a class from me. Do a advanced type of class where we go over mindset. We put you through the drills. We make sure that the last thing you got to think about is how to handle your weapon or when to fire. All you got to think about is what's the person doing? What do I need to do to stop that person? Not is the gun unsafe? What kind of trigger pull does it have? Where is the gun in my body? Can I get the gun out? Do I know if I can hit the target or not? So on and so forth. The last thing I should be thinking about, or the only thing I should be thinking about, is the threat that is in front of me. Okay. All that other stuff has to be done before that situation happens. And ladies and gentlemen, you can't train when the stuff hits the fan. You got to train before the stuff hits the fan. Okay. So that's the deal on that. Reckless injury of an innocent third person. Every bullet has an attorney attached to it. Every bullet has a stopping point. Make sure your bullet stays where it's supposed to in most cases, and so that the attorney that's attached to it is a favorable one.
Not attached to it the way you may want.
Clarify.
An attorney. I just had this image of you shooting an attorney.
Oh, no. Gosh, no. No, not at all. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's licensed here. If you got a question, give us a call here at 697-6633. Give me an email at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com. Or just go directly to the website, aaronsgunshop.com. Okay, that's licensed to carry. Let's move on to our NRA section. In this section, I'm going to read to you four stories today from the NRA's Armed Citizens page of the American Rifleman. And hopefully from these true stories, we can learn what to do and what not to do, and maybe even get a laugh or two in the process. All depends on the story. Now, if you're not a member of the NRA, you might consider becoming one, because the more gun supporters they have, the more muscle they have to stop bad legislation. So here we go. We got four stories today. This is coming out of February of 2000. And story number one goes as follows. Now, Trey, I'm going to read my comments, and I want you to give me some initial reactions to the story, what you think. James, I can't read this. Too small. James Sakes was awakened about 2:45 a.m. by noises outside his Port Sulphur, Louisiana home. He picked up his pistol, went out to investigate, and found a man breaking into his truck. The man ran toward Sakes, holding something shiny in his hand. Fearing for his life, Sakes shot the would-be assailant, who then ran into the woods. Police arrested a man identified as Jonathan Williams, who sustained a gunshot wound to the abdomen. Williams was to be charged with aggravated burglary upon his release from the hospital, according to Major John Marie of the Someplace Sheriff's Department. Okay, here's my commentary. What I want to highlight on this story is how James immediately went for his gun before he investigated. Many stories tell us of how people find threats, then go arm themselves. Now, if you're going to do that, then don't even have a gun. And what's the sense? I'm going to run to the threat, say, oh my gosh, there is a threat. Let me go run back.
Hold on a second. Yeah. I'll be right back.
That goes for you people who don't carry one in the chamber, too. Do you carry air in your spare tire? Of course you do. So what's your reaction to that?
I mean, not much to react.
Same
not
thing?
Much to react. I mean, he did what sounded just fine.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Pretty cut and dry. Okay, story number two. A Maples, New York man shot and killed an intruder who broke into his house in the middle of the night and threatened him. Michael, I can't pronounce his name. Michael was awakened by his 11-year-old son, who told him someone was in their house. Michael loaded his 12-gauge shotgun and started down the steps to find out what was going on. He was confronted by Brian Dibble, who had previously dated Michael's girlfriend. Chief Deputy Don DeSmith of the Ontario County Sheriff's Department reported, "We're not sure exactly what was said, but apparently Mr. Dibble threatened Mike with bodily harm. After being threatened, Mike shot Dibble once in the chest. The intruder was pronounced dead at the scene. Prior to the incident, Dibble was said to have broken into his old girlfriend's home next door." Okay. My commentary. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, the defending person got his gun first. Very good. The bad guy, in my opinion, received due justice. Do I need to go any further on that one?
Well, I'm torn between the guy had already broken in once and obviously was somewhere he didn't need to be. But if all he did was threaten, why not just hold him at gunpoint and then call the police or have your son call the police?
Well, let's see. In the middle of the night, they broke into his house. I'm going to stop right there, buddy. Let's just leave it at that. All right. Story number three. A 19-year-old Middleton, Maryland man was shot and killed when he opened fire on two motorists stopped at a red light. The man in the second of the two cars drew his own gun and shot back. Andre Lamont Hill approached a car stopped at a red light in Baltimore at 10:20 p.m. and fired multiple times, hitting that car and a car directly behind it. When the second car was sprayed with bullets, the driver, who had a permit to carry a gun, fired back, striking Hill several times in the head. The motive for the attack was unknown, according to the Baltimore police. My commentary. Ladies and gentlemen, the motive was unknown. Stuff can happen at any time. Are you at least trying to pay attention to your surroundings and being prepared? We can't prepare for everything, but we can at least stay aware, maybe give us a little edge on things, right? And that just tells you anything can happen any way, anyhow, anytime. So just be at the ready.
I'm not so sure that the motive matters. The dude was shooting at you.
That's right. It doesn't matter the motive. The motive is I'm going to die if I don't do something. Okay, last story here. From the moment two young men walked into Gary Lee's market one afternoon, the owner's wife, Kathy Lee, knew there was trouble. She noticed the pair avoided eye contact with store employees, and the hooded jackets they wore were too warm for the season. Her fears proved right moments later when one of the men pulled a gun and aimed it at the store clerk. Kathy had already alerted her husband that there was trouble, and he emerged from the back of the store with a 9mm pistol. He aimed in the direction of the robbers and fired. The pair of would-be bandits flew from the store empty-handed. Three Brunswick, Georgia men were arrested in connection with the attempted robbery. And store proprietor Lee said he felt he had to stand up to the gunmen. When they had the gun, they were in control. But that changed when I came out with my gun, he said. My commentary. To all you anti-gunners out there, I say this to you. Screw you. You will not get my guns for the very reason that Gary Lee just stated. And that is, when they have the guns, they're in control. But when I have the gun, I'm in control. Good luck getting my gun. All right, moving on. If you don't like it, I don't care. Give me a call. 254-697-6633. And we'll put you on the air. All right, Trey, let's take a break.
Let's take a break.
And when we come back, we'll go over our pep section and any other little tidbits of information I can give you. Once again, the number is 254-697-6633. If you have a story that you used a firearm for self-defense, or let's say common sense for self-defense, give us a call. 254-697-6633. Share your story so others may learn. See you on the other side. App Adventure Radio program. We've got an hour and a half left of the show here live. We've got lots of things going on. But first, once again, let me remind you, it's October 8th, 2016. And today, Saturday at 2 o'clock, I have a license to carry class. There's still time to sign up for it. Need you there by about 10 minutes to 2. It's $60 for a new course. Anybody who has a license already and wants a refresher, which I highly recommend, it's $40. And we'll be going over the laws, all the requirements necessary for the state for you to get your certificate to apply for a license to carry. So it's at 2 o'clock. Give us a call here at the studio, 254-697-6633. Let us know you're going to be coming, and we'll get a spot set up for you. Also, we have a home invasion self-defense training seminar November 5th. We had to change the date, November 5th. Just in time for the election. So when all chaos breaks loose because people aren't happy who got elected, whatever way it may go, you'll be somewhat prepared, okay? So it's a great course. Go to the Aaron's Gunshop.com website and go to the High Cap Adventure page, and you'll see the flyer up there. It'll tell you all the things that we're going to do there. It's a lot of fun, great training. You need it. Give me a call, sign up, and we'll get you squared away. Now, let's talk about our pep section. We are a prepper show to some degree here, a whole bunch of different things, but basically we talk about how we can be prepared. So our pep section is two things. Preparedness eliminates panic, or practice eliminates panic. Let's talk preparedness for a moment. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when when you put your head on your pillow and drift off to dream world, are you the least bit prepared for that bump in the night or the intruder in your house? Even if you are prepared, you yourself have to be able to function right after being abruptly woken up. Are you awake? Is your brain functioning? Are you like me and the joints need a few moments to limber up? Are you sleeping naked? Do you have, not that I want to know if you're sleeping naked, but I'm saying, if you're sleeping naked, do you have clothes at the ready, including shoes, in case you have to get dressed quickly? Is your gun at the ready? Or do you keep it locked up in a safe? Do you even know the combination at 3 o'clock in the morning? Do you immediately turn on the light and call out to ask if someone is there and totally give up your tactical advantage? Now look, if you rob my house and hear nothing from anyone in the house, oh my, are you in a deep doo-doo. You're in deep doo-doo. You're a thought process away from being shot. I will rain fire upon you, okay? That's alarms, obstacles, tactical awareness, and supreme firepower awaits you. So that's what I'm saying about being prepared. Have your stuff ready, because at 3 o'clock in the morning, who knows what can happen? Are you, the listener, prepared like this, or are you a sitting duck at the mercy of someone who breaks into your home at 3 o'clock in the morning? Extreme prejudice should be held against anyone breaking into your home of another, especially at night. So to answer the question, do you sleep in confidence? I know I do, and I can help you do the same. Take a course from me. I just mentioned it before. My next self-defense and home invasion seminar is November 5th. That's a Saturday, November 5th, Saturday. And like I said, with the presidential election taking place only a few days later, it might be a good idea to be prepared. Ladies and gentlemen, the home invasion training seminar goes over a lot of things. It really does. And if you take that course, you're going to feel so much more prepared. I'll give you an example. The most important thing that I teach in this seminar is mindset. If your mindset is not there, if you're just in la-la land, if you're not paying attention, if you're not taking it serious, if you're doing it for giggles, somebody's going to get hurt. It's most likely going to be you, okay? So the first thing we do is mindset. The other thing, we find out where you are in your thought process about carrying or handling a weapon. It's a little bit different than the mindset. Because a person, like if I say on a scale from 1 to 10, what's your thought process and about carrying a weapon or using a weapon? And 10 is, I have no problems. I will do it exactly when necessary. No hesitations. The whole works. That would be a 10. But if you go, I don't know, you know, I should probably have one in the house. I'll put it there. I'll keep it here. I'll lock it up here. That would be like a 1. Okay. So what I do is I find out what your number is, what your mindset is, or your thought processes of your capabilities. And then during the course of the day, it's like we put it on a scale. If we got the scale and we put your number, let's say you decided you're an 8, and we put the 8 on the scale, well, the scale is going to drop down, right? Well, now I'm going to watch you to see if your physical ability to run the gun is equal to an 8 or higher. Because if your ability to run the gun is less than your mental attitude about carrying or using a gun, we have an imbalance. An imbalance is going to cause a problem. Can't have it. So we're going to go over that. Another aspect that is incredibly fun and great to learn is our round robins. And we have a competition coming up next Friday. Every second Friday of the month, we have our pistol competition. And I took out this aspect of the self-defense training seminar, the round robin, and use it for our pistol competitions every second Friday of the month. And if you want to check out the rules on the pistol competition, you can go to aaronsgunshop.com's homepage, and up at the top, there's a link for the rules. You can click on it and see what it's all about. But the round robin basically is this. Depending on how many students I have in a class, if I have a little, I'll add guns. If I have a lot, I just use their guns. But we'll put all the guns, all the different guns on the table. in different forms of readiness. One could have a stovepipe. One could have a double feed. One could not be chambered. One could be totally empty, slide locked to the rear. One could be totally empty, magazine out, slides to the forward position. Safety's on, safety's off, double action trigger, single action triggers, double action onlys, revolvers, all these different types of guns. So if you're having a situation happening to you and you lose your gun in the sense of it doesn't work, you couldn't get to it, it malfunctioned, and you have no time, but there's another one available around, it might have what we call a battlefield pickup. It's just laying there and you don't know what condition it's in. This training that you go through has common threads. It enables you to pick up just about any gun and get it up and running in matter of moments, mere seconds, okay? Because we train you and you understand the concepts, the basic working concepts of these guns. And it's unbelievable. I'm telling you, somebody who hesitates or is weary or is fearful or nervous or scared, if they make the decision to go there, they cannot say how happy and glad they finally make that decision to take it. I had a young lady come take the pistol competition last month. Was hesitant and hesitant. Now the adrenaline's pumping. Can't wait for the next one. They just want to participate. It's a lot of fun because they realize, wow, this is fantastic training. So those are some of the things that we do. We do malfunction training. We also have our shoot house, and we have an aggressor in the shoot house who's breaking into your home, and you've got to go room to room and learn all the different techniques on going from room to room, being quiet. And I've got a video. If you go to aaronsgunshop.com, go to the Facebook page, or I'm sorry, the radio page, you'll see the interview I had with my son, my acting crackhead. He comes home from school and he pretends like he's the crackhead breaking into your home, and he's very good. He's like a ninja. So you got to be on your toes, be aware and prepared, turning corners, going down hallways. So it's a lot of good training. You can apply all these different skills to your own home. So sleeping in confidence, make sure you're prepared mentally, physically, have the proper tools available so that you can sleep peaceful at night. Always though, I mean, no matter what you do, there's always room for something to happen. So you've got to be prepared. But we try to minimize your confusion in the middle of the night, try to minimize your worry or fear in the middle of the night with preparedness. So give us a call, give us an email, go to aaronsgunshop.com, go to the High Cap Adventure page, give us a call here at 254-697-6633. That's right here in the studio. And don't forget, at 2 o'clock today, I've got a license to carry class. And if you want a refresher course, it's $40. If you're a new person wanting to get your certificate, it's $60. So that's that on that. Let's move on. Topic of interest. My very good friend, Bill Banlow, the owner of WRBSales.com down in Gun Barrel, Texas. No, that's not a joke. He makes incredible products, high-quality products, and a wide range of products. Check him out, wrbsales.com. And the topic of interest section here is not particular holster in particular. It's about holsters in general when it comes to putting them on your body. Because Bill Banlow and his company, WRB Sales, he makes all these. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you about the different places to carry a holster. And then once you decide, hey, this might be a good place for me, or I like what he's saying, I never thought about this, go check out his website, WRB Sales, and look at all the different varieties and styles of holsters that he has for these particular ones. And I'll give you an example. We've got shoulder holsters, hip holsters, and ankle holsters. I mean, those are just the three basic things. If you look at your body, where can I carry a gun that's not detached, like ladies with a purse or something? We're talking, it's going to be on your shoulder, at your waist, or at your ankle. And there's different things to look at. Look, ladies and gentlemen, I've been carrying and shooting guns since I was 4 years old, okay? I've been doing concealment with handguns for, gosh, almost 30 years now. I used to carry up in New York. And believe it or not, I had a license to carry in New York. I still had it, but I'm not a resident there anymore. I've been teaching and training this. I've got boxes full of holsters, and I know what works and what doesn't work for this person here talking behind the microphone. Maybe I can share some of this with you and tell you what to look for. But on a shoulder holsters were a preferred method of carry for me up in New York because the weather was more, it permitted me more to able to wear clothing to cover it up. But down here, when I thought, oh, I'm going to wear my shoulder rigs, forget about it. It's too hot. gets in the way. You sweat, all that kind of stuff. But if you are going to wear a shoulder holster, let's say in the cooler months, we're coming upon those cooler months now, there's things that you can look for when it comes to a shoulder rig. The questions that you have to ask first, do I want a vertical style shoulder holster? Do I want a horizontal? Do I want it strapped to my belt? Do I want it free floating? And materials and movement. Let me clarify this. If you're a skinny person, okay, whether you're a man or a female, now on a woman, up on top, you've got things guys don't have. Depending on how large those are, will determine if maybe you might be able to carry the gun in a horizontal position. Now, I'm not trying to be funny here. I'm totally dead serious, okay? A woman who's larger on top may be able to get away with a gun in the horizontal position and still flow with the shape of her body and her clothing so that it won't print if she's wearing like a jacket. It'll kind of recess in the curves of her body. A guy, if he's pretty skinny and he's wearing a horizontal rig and he's wearing a jacket, you're going to sometimes notice things poking out from the backside by his ribs or in the front by his chest because the way the gun is setting. For people like that, it'd probably be more preferable to wear a vertical shoulder holster. So it goes up and down with the line of your body and it's more concealable when wearing a jacket. Okay. Another aspect of the shoulder holster is, do I wear it strapped to my belt or do I have it free floating? Many people have said to me, man, why don't you strap that down to your pants? And I go, well, because I've worn shoulder holsters most of my gun life, and I know that it doesn't work best for me in the situations that I do. Here are the pros and cons. If you're wearing a shoulder holster and it's strapped to your belt, it's going to rise up on you. Your pants are going to rise up. They just are, okay? It may not be much. It's going to be a little bit. You get that little tight feeling down there. It kind of gets a little awkward, okay? But I can tell if somebody's worn them enough, you can tell, hey, somebody's got a shoulder rig on. I can tell by the way the pants are acting. The positive side to that is it stays close to your body. It doesn't move around at all. But the negative side is, let's say you're wearing a sports jacket and you lean over, your jacket's going to open up if it's not buttoned, and there's your gun to see for everybody to see. If the gun is free floating and not attached to your belt, as you lean over and the gun drapes down, and the jacket drapes down, the gun drapes with the coat and is hidden with inside the coat. I've done it many a times. It works perfectly. Then people say, well, what if you have to run? Very simple. I tuck my elbows in and I run. It may look a little awkward, but I can do it just fine. I've been doing it for years and it's never has hindered me. So you've got those two things to look at. Now, the other thing is the materials that it's made of. I want to try and explain this. A certain type of material like suede on the shoulder areas, it's going to stick to your clothing. It's not going to really move much, and it ends up starting to bind on your clothing. Nothing wrong with it. It's great. Many people have been wearing it for life. But if you haven't worn different types of holsters, you might not know the differences, the plus and the minuses. If you get some type of material that is slicker than suede, it's just smooth, what happens is, you put this shoulder holster on you, get it fitted right, and you can literally move within the confines of your shoulder holster straps. So the gun is actually going to be staying somewhat motionless, and you're moving within the confines of your leather straps, which makes it very comfortable. It doesn't fall off your body, but you're able to move within the confines of your straps. So that's the thing to look at. All right, now let's move it on here. We just talked about the shoulder holster. There's many other things too, but time is prohibitive here. The hip holster, you can wear it on the inside of your pants or on the outside on your hip. I'm a holsterless type of guy when I wear it in my pants. I don't like holsters in my pants because the gun is big enough as it is. The holster has two sides to it to keep the gun in. You almost add a third of the size of the gun depending on the type of holster, except for WRB Sales. And I'm not saying that because he's a sponsor. I'm saying it because it's the truth. The materials that they use are very thin and durable, so I can get away with a holster like that in my pants. And those are really the only ones I use because of the materials and the design and style that they are. If you wear it on the outside, there's some things about outside holsters I don't like. There's a lot of bulk. You'll see a lot of these like Blackhawk holsters. It's got these Kydex type of holsters. They fit the gun perfectly, but there's this big thing sticking off the side of your hip. It's very difficult to conceal. Now, if you're wearing in the open, that's fine. But to conceal that type of gun with that type of holster is very difficult. Now, we've got these holsters in the shop right now. It almost looks like a pancake or a flapjack. It's got a couple slots in it. It's a one piece of leather. You put it on your belt. And what's nice about it is if you don't use it, you push it up against your body. If you do use it, you open it up, put the gun in there. WRB Sales has multitude types of holsters that you can check out. So if you're thinking that the hip is the way to go, go to WRBSales.com and check out all their hip holsters. Now let's talk about the ankle holster. The ankle holster is not my preferred method of wearing a gun. However, it's a great method to wear a gun at a time, or if you don't have a shirt on or it needs to be concealed, or you just want to have one around you, it's great, but it's not a quick access type of holster. The other thing you have to think about too is, what leg do I want it on? Do I want it on my left leg or right leg? Do I want it on the outside? Do I want it on the inside? If you can picture your leg, your calf muscle, you'll notice as you're looking down the leg, you got the calf muscle, and then it gets more narrow as it goes down your ankle. In that area where it recesses is where you want to put your gun, so it looks more like your leg and not this bulge sticking out at your ankle. Some people wear, if they're a right-handed shooter, they'll wear it on the right leg on the right side. That's just bulk, bulk, bulk. If you're a right-handed shooter, what I would recommend is putting the ankle holster on your left leg with the gun on the inside. So as you go down, bend down to lift up your pant leg, your right arm kind of crosses over and grabs the gun from the inside of your left leg. That's the best way because it's more concealable. It doesn't print in your pants. It doesn't show that there's a potential gun down there at your ankle. It's just a lot more covert. So there's different things to think about, and WRB Sales has all these holsters made out of top quality materials. Go to WRBSalesNow.com, go to WRBSales.com, check them out, all the different things, gun bags, holsters, magazine pouches, shoulder holsters, hip holsters, all sorts of things. So check them out at WRBSales.com. You'll see a lot of those things. Very good. Okay, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to go over our product spotlight from our other sponsor, ANC Firearms out in Heidenhammer, and we're going to talk about the awesome, incredible 1911. Welcome back, everybody, to the Aaron's High Cap Adventure Radio program. Again, today is October 8th, 2016, and we're still here live. My heart's still beating, so we're good to go. Let's talk about our product spotlight. Sponsored by ANC Firearms in Heidenhammer. Very good friend of mine, Arch Kuntz, owner of ANC Firearms. Incredible guy. Will do whatever he can to help you when it comes to finding and selecting the proper gun. Now, we're going to talk about the incredible 1911, which he has on his shelves. They're just fantastic. It's an ingenious design by John Moses Browning. This guy was a gift from the Lord. I mean, this guy is incredible. His brain can just figure things out and come up with these products that are well over 100 years old, battle proven. Look, I eat, sleep, and drink 1911s. And first thing, I've got my trusty one right here. Ladies and gentlemen, let me hear everybody together. Let me hear you tell me, what's the first thing you do when somebody gives you a weapon? It's the first thing you do besides saying thank you. You clear it. You make sure it's not loaded so you don't shoot somebody or yourself. So the first thing we're going to do is take out the magazine, because we don't want to rack the slide first because we could accidentally put one in the chamber, right? So the first thing we do is we take out the mag. The mag is empty. Trey, you confirm? Okay. Then we're going to always keep our finger off the trigger all the while keeping it on the pulse of America. But all right, now I'm going to rack the slide to the rear, and I'm looking in the chamber and the magazine well. Trey, will you confirm for me, please, that that weapon is clear? Thank you, sir. Clear. Weapon is clear. Okay. This weapon is fantastic. If you looked at my Facebook page, you'll see the picture of it, and I'm just going to talk to you about it. Remember now, you can get this beautiful 1911, not mine, this is mine, there's only one like it. How do you Marines say it? This is my gun, there are many like it, but this one is mine, something like that. Ooh. Now, it's battle proven. It comes in different sizes, different calibers, different finishes. It's copied by everyone. It's got the best trigger ever to begin with. And then you can modify it to make it even better than that. It has accessible parts all over the world. It comes in single stack or high capacity. It's got variable price range. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let's go over this. It's battle proven. If I'm going to carry a gun, think about this. The guns that are awesome are guns that are test proven by the military. They spend millions of dollars to test out weapons to make sure that they're okay. So why wouldn't I want to carry a military style weapon that's been proven in battle? Okay, first thing. Different sizes. What I like about this gun, and many guns are like this, but this particular one, I can get it in a 5-inch barrel, 4 1/4 inch, 3.5 inch, 3-inch barrel. But what's nice is all the mechanisms stay the same. I grab the weapon, everything's the same no matter what size gun or what size caliber it is. I can get this gun in 22, 9mm, 40 caliber, 45. I think they even got a 50. Whatever, they've got it. It's a fantastic gun. The trigger, let me talk to you about the trigger. I always tell people that triggers are key, are absolutely key when it comes to selecting a handgun. If you have short fingers, the last thing you want is a long trigger pull on a gun, because then you got to start reaching for the gun and the gun is kind of crooked in your hand. On a 1911, it takes approximately 3 to 5 pounds of trigger pull to pull this trigger. It has a minimal pull amount, travel time, and reset on the trigger is very minimal. I was going to explain that to you in my gun training demo, which I may not have time for today, but we'll see. Back to the 1911. The 1911 is minimal on its mass. And what I mean by that is there are some guns out there that have more metal to them. They're more boxy. They're more brickish. The 1911 is more slick, thinner, trimmer. Simply, when you put it in your pants, like in front of your waist there, it just fits right. It just fits where it's supposed to fit. And depending on how tall you are or short you are, they have different barrel lengths. I'll give you an example. I'm a short 6-foot person. I could carry a 5-inch 1911 in my pants, but when I go to sit down, you know. So I prefer to carry a 4-inch or shorter because there's, you know, it's minimal space down there. Okay, let's go back to the 1911. Everybody says Glocks are great, and XDs are great, and they are. They're fantastic guns. But if you're a lover of the 1911, what's better than a 1911? A 1911 in high capacity, okay? You got a Glock 21 that carries, I think, what, 14 rounds? Well, you can get a high-capacity 1911 that has a double-stack mag and carry 14 rounds. So you've got the best of both worlds. You got the high-capacity, like the black guns. You've got the beautiful trigger pull and trigger reset of the 1911. You've got the minimal mass when it comes to the slide and the frame. You got a battle-proven design, and it just looks good. Now, I tell people all the time, when they finally buy a 1911, that they grew up. They finally got into the real gun world and have a 1911. Look, if you own guns and you don't have a 1911, it's just like an AK-47. You need to get one. Those are just some things you got to have in your collection, is a 1911. It's accurate gun. I love it to death. And you can go to ANC Firearms in Heidenhammer right now. Call them up, 254-983-4417. And they can get you and talk to you about any style that you want and any price range you want. And I'll tell you this, too. Very rarely can I find a 1911 from the cheapest platform that doesn't do pretty darn good. Okay? I mean, you can get cheap, and you'll notice parts are not made as well. But the way it handles, the way it shoots is good. You go up just a little bit in the $400 to $500 range, and you get yourself incredible 1911, starting like with the Rock Island Armories, incredible gun. And then you can keep going up to para ordinances and Kimbers and all that. If you want to spend $2,000 on a Les Baird that, you know, spit on and polished by that guy, and just because he did that, it's $2,000, you can do that. You can get yourself a competition 1911 gun. It's a phenomenal gun, fantastic. And if you don't have one, you should get one. Call ANC Firearms and Heidenhammer up today. They sponsor the program here, and so they support me. I ask that you support them. Call them first, 254-983-4417. Okay, with that, we're going to take a long break, and when we come back at about 11 o'clock hour, we are going to have with us the voice of law enforcement, Cameron Police Chief Randy Dixon. Be back on the other side. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Aaron's High Cap Adventure Radio program. I'm going to immediately introduce you to Cameron Police Chief Randy Dixon, the voice of law enforcement.
Good morning, everybody. Hope everybody's having a great Saturday morning. You know, we had a good night last night. The Yeoman, they barely beat the Gerald team. Ha. Poor old Gerald didn't have a chance last night. But on the good part today, you know, got the Texas Longhorns playing here. Actually, right now, the same time I'm on the radio. And I know we're not in Longhorn country, but unfortunately, I'm kind of a burnt orange person. But if you'll excuse that with me today, but enjoy the fall weather day. Get out and do something. Get out and do something productive for yourself. Have fun today. Now, what are we going to talk about today? Well, I thought about that a lot. You know, Hurricane Matthew's coming up through along the eastern seaboard, and I thought, well, something on preparedness. Well, I've done that before, but we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show today. But what I really want to talk about today is the reality of crime. You say, what in the world is reality of crime? Well, you know, I don't know about you, but every time I see a CSI or some kind of show on TV, I'm marveled by how good investigators those people are, how they can do something, how they can have a murder happen, and within 10 minutes they've got it solved. Folks, that's not reality, and that's what I want to touch on today, the reality of crimes. You know, I want to talk about how the realistic approach to solving crimes and to not being a victim of crime actually should be and is. You know, the popularity of high-tech crime-solving shows such as Miami CSI, Law & Order, and their assorted spinoffs has dramatically increased the public awareness of the role that science can play in law enforcement today in solving crimes and gathering evidence. You know, but folks, you got to keep that all in perspective. You know, the fictional investigators, the realistic counterparts who they try to play as real cops, have found the newfound visibility of their profession and its tools that are, you know, it's kind of a mixed blessing for us. It gives us a lot of insight, gives people a lot of insight into what law enforcement is, but it also creates a false bond many times with that. You know, the shows create issues for us here in Cameron as well by giving, and then not just here in Cameron, but everywhere as well, folks, by giving would-be criminals or those who are trying to break the law and the system ideas on how to do such. Yeah, and that is one of the drawbacks of it. You know, sometimes people feed into that. Sometimes they feed into their mind about what could happen and what couldn't happen. Now, one of the bad things we do is that sometimes jurors, and we have to count on you, the public, to be our jury system. Jurors, in turn, are sometimes puzzled when the prosecution scientific experts carefully and sometimes in a lot of detail qualify their findings with similar to or consistent with, rather than speaking with the actual nonchalant precision of that is a definite yes or that is a definite no. Sometimes there are no definite no's or there are no positives or negatives. Sometimes it's in generalizations. You know, here, not just too long ago, Arizona State University formed a team of psychologists who found that regular viewers of CSI and similar shows actually were more skeptical of scientific evidence than non-viewers. Now, how could that be? Well, it's real simple. They're smart. They use their head. You know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that when you watch a television show and you've only got, for instance, say 40 minutes on an hour show to get all of your information in, it's going to have to be concise. It's going to have shortcuts. And that is not reality, folks. That is not the way life works. In any case, for those who might confuse TV crime solving with real life investigational tools, there are some key differences, folks. On TV, stylish-dressed forensic scientists never get messy. It seems like they're always clean. In real life, myself and other Cameron police officers have often looked like ragtag dolls after doing the crime scene or investigating it. I remember back a number of years ago when I was in another former life as a police officer in Temple, we had a very large burglary that happened at one of our junior high schools there in the town. Ended up having to process a couple of rooms, the library, the office, etc., with fingerprints. And I'm telling you, for a week, for a solid week, every time I sneezed or coughed, black fingerprint powder came out my nose. That's the reality of crime scene investigations. It's not clean. It's not messy. Give you another example. One time, we had a gentleman who was a good friend of mine, actually, when I graduated high school with there in Temple, who had his white Corvette burglarized. They stole his T-tops, took his stereo system out, and he absolutely insisted that we take fingerprints. Well, folks, you really don't understand until you have had to do it one time how messy fingerprints are. We complied even after warning him, and that black leather interior of his Corvette, or I'm sorry, that white leather interior of his Corvette ended up being partially gray. It was black. It was messy. Then he became angry with us. And as the old saying goes, be careful what you wish for. You know, in real life, bullets often are deformed when somebody shoots them, but on TV, they pull bullets out and they can see them under a microscope and tell what kind of gun they shot from a million miles away. Doesn't happen, folks. Crime investigation is something that takes time, it takes finesse, it takes investigational needs. You can't solve most crimes in a matter of minutes. It takes a while to do it. You know, and isn't it amazing how investigators can sometimes pick up a weapon and with a handkerchief or with inserting a pistol in the barrel like you've all seen on TV? What that does, that right there, for instance, can taint the evidence. It could put DNA on the evidence. It could do a lot of things. There are certain protocols that are followed, and people don't understand that. I know that, you know, in around the U.S., we've had a rash of shootings, not only of police officers. Matter of fact, in the last 3 days, four police officers have been murdered across this country with gunfire. And sometimes those bodies will lay out underneath sheets or underneath it for hours upon hours upon hours. And people say, get them out of there. Why do they have to do that? Folks, you've got to do an investigation. It's not television. It's real. It takes time. It takes a while to be able to go through things and to see how things work. When a TV investigator lifts a print from a crime scene, invariably they take it back and they put it in this fancy computer that can tell them to a matter of seconds exactly who the person is that left that fingerprint. That is not reality either, folks. Fingerprints in real life, the database is sketchy at most. Unless that person has either been arrested or printed for some other reason, the chances are comparing that print are very nil and void. It takes a human being to actually examine them to get the idea about it. You know, usually the results are studied by humans, by actual humans who make the determinations on whether that print is usable or not. Not to say that we're not going to take prints. I mean, that still is something that we have to do, and that's something that we need to do. But they are not the telltale victim crime-solving crime that people think they are. When a Cameron police officer responds to a crime scene, many times our folks seem almost disappointed when we don't take fingerprints, our complainants do. Rarely is there enough evidence gathered from a print to be able to prosecute someone from just a fingerprint, folks. That's why, don't be disappointed if an officer comes out, if you had your car burglarized or something, and if we take fingerprints and we tell you there's no usable prints. It's not that simple. With that being said, though, folks, officers are going to take prints when possible, but the prints are, you know, they're not a panacea. They're really not. When a Cameron police officer dusts the crime scene for a print, we in turn send any results which may be gathered to a fingerprint expert in a larger city usually. We don't have an AFIS computer, which is common in larger police departments, which ties it to nationwide. You know, one of the things that many people get really frustrated with is if you've ever watched CSI Miami, and, you know, or CSI New York or whatever they may be, they have the DNA evidence. You know, I don't know what people think, but DNA evidence, a lot of times people think that that is something that we can swab for, we can take, in just a matter of minutes, send it to someplace, and they'll get it back. There are instances, even right here in Cameron, where we've sent off DNA evidence, and we're still waiting for it 4 to 6 months away. There's only one or two labs in the state that will check DNA evidence. So, folks, it's a time-consuming situation. It's not overnight. Police officers, investigators, local justice peace, and whoever they are, and, you know, those that have to deal with the mortuary service, we've seen things that most people never get to see in life and hopefully never will see in life. And that's something that I think I give credit to our police officers for, my officers in particular. On a nightly basis, they'll see things, they'll deal with issues that most people never have to deal with in a lifetime. And with that being said, they're still going to do their job. It's hard. We talk about PTSD many times in our military. Police officers, firefighters, ambulance attendants, EMS, PTSD is real and alive in their lives as well, folks. Trust me. There are things that have happened in my career, spanned over the last 43 years, that I go to bed almost every night thinking about and wish I didn't have to think about. But it's something you never get out of your mind. Now, television shows have done a lot with law enforcement. I don't know about you, but on Friday nights, one of my favorite shows that come on is Blue Bloods. You know, and last night they were had a show involving a victim who didn't want to testify, and in reference to a sexual assault case. We're dependent. We're dependent on testimony. We're dependent on people, not just what we can gather from a crime scene. Your best asset to help law enforcement to be a reality is your eyes, your ears, and the ability to be able to relate what you see. One of the things that I do find very frustrating for those of us who believe in the right thing to do and the right thing is the people who do see something and they won't get involved. You know, many times we seem like we don't know what we're doing in law enforcement. And sometimes we don't, because there's no stock answer for every situation that comes along. But you have to trust the fact that most of the officers that work here in Cameron and in this area have years and years of experience and knowledge on how they do their job. You may not understand it, but they understand it. And that's the detail. You know, and, you know, I'm not trying to make excuses for law enforcement at all. But I do hope that to give you some ideas about what reality is and what reality is not. Reality is you have to investigate every crime till its fullest. It would really be great if our television executives would take the time to do a reality show on how to prevent crime and how to prevent criminal activity instead of actually how to solve it. You know, we have plenty of shows on TV about Naked and Afraid, Survivor, about being an extreme tow truck driver, or even Alaska State Trooper, and on. But rarely do we see any reality shows and how we as common everyday citizens can make our lives safer by using just a few safety and crime prevention techniques. That is the key, folks. The key is prevention ahead of time. Take the time to do things that's going to minimize your chance of being a criminal. A number of years ago, the Home and Garden Channel, and for those of you that watch it, I have no life, so I watch that, used to give a common sense ideas about home security. They'd show you how to do things. They'd show you how to build things. They'd show you how to secure your house. But like everything else, now they've taken to the world of reality. It seems like people are more interested in what happens to people than how to prevent what happens to our own selves. Take the time as a homeowner, a landowner, whatever you may be, or apartment dweller, to learn how to secure your home and valuables. It only takes a little while. It doesn't take a lot of work, and it doesn't cost you any money. Give us a call at the Cameron Police Department. We'll be happy to tell you what to do to document your ideas and how to protect yourself. Remember, folks, that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that adage is never more true. Television is just not reality, folks. You know, and I ask you, and I guess I hate to use the word, but I beg you, take the time to secure your home. I really get amused and amazed how many times we can drive around at nighttime, especially here in Cameron, and I can see houses that have the garage doors open. They have no lights turned on around their home. That is just an invitation for things to happen to you. Your electricity is going to cost you less than 10 simple cents a month to keep a light on in front of your house every single night, or on the back of your house every single night. Electricity is not expensive when it comes to lighting. Unfortunately, too many people take what they see on TV as the gospel. It's kind of like on the internet. If the internet says it's true, by golly, it must be true. Folks, y'all are smart. Everyone who's listening to this radio show, all 10,000 of you, are smart, knowing that y'all know how to protect yourselves. You know what to do. Sure, you can put a 1911 down in the front of your pants and hold on to it, but that 1911 is not going to protect you when you're sleeping. You've got to know how to protect yourself beforehand. You've got to know how to be able to use that 1911 if you're going to depend upon it to be a protector. Now, one other thing I want to talk about, just real briefly, and a side note. I want you to look at your own house. I want you to look at your own business. And tell me if you've got numbers on your house or your business. Here I am. Let's say that I'm working the deep night, darkest midnight shift in this city. And you call in that you've got somebody trying to break into your house. And it may be on whatever street it may be on. Rennie Drive. It might be on Jackson. It might be on Carnes. It doesn't make any difference what town, what street it is. We dispatch a police officer, maybe two police officers if we're lucky, that have them working. We send them to your house. Well, lo and behold, they drive down the street, and you don't have any numbers on your house. You don't have a number that says, I live at 701 East 14th Street, or 1811, whatever it may be. Put a number on your house, folks. If the police officers can't find your house, they can't help you. The same goes true. The exact same goes true for EMS. Matter of fact, we had an incident that happened about 2 weeks ago. And it, once again, it was on night shift when it's dark and you can't see a whole lot. And we only have spotlights on our cars to illuminate your house if you're not going to have your lights turned on. And there was an individual that was having a, we believe to be a stroke. They called EMS, and folks on here in Cameron, we're very fortunate that, and the majority of our police cars, we carry AEDs, automatic external defibrillators. And usually we're the first ones who arrive on scene if someone's having a medical emergency. You know, the ambulance people have to call to get woke up. Well, our officers are out there, and they arrive first, usually. But we couldn't find the house because there were no numbers on the house. It delayed for a matter of minutes. And I don't know about you, but if I'm not breathing, a matter of minutes makes a lot of difference to an officer. Our officers are trained for CPR. They're trained how to do basic emergency medicine until an ambulance or to the EMS personnel arrive. Do me a favor. Take the time. Go down to your hardware store. Go down to wherever you may want to go. Buy you a set of numbers that are at least 3 inches tall. Put them on your front of your house somewhere. Put them where we can see them. Don't put them behind a bush where you can't see them. If this bush is there, it's not doing you any good, not doing us any good. Put you some numbers so we can see where we need to go to help you. With that being said, folks, you know, there's a lot of things that you can do to protect yourselves. Don't leave valuables laying out. It's kind of funny. I had a man call me here not too long ago that was just, he was madder than an old wet hen. And what he was saying is, how come the police officers couldn't keep people from stealing this, that, and the other? And I said, well, sir, you know, we do our best job we can. This is a city that's a number of square miles. We usually have an X number of police officers that are working. We can't put X number of police officers on every single block in this city. Don't think the city budget would quite afford that. Well, he continued to tell me how much he really thought about me and my department, which is fine. I've got a thick skin. And then I asked him, I said, well, where was it at when this item was stolen? Well, it was out front of my house. And I'm thinking to myself, you've got something that you say that is worth X number of thousands of dollars, and you leave it laying in front of your house, unsecured, in the middle of the night, with no lights turned on. I wanted to say, duh, but being the professional I am, I said, yes, sir, we will do our best to protect your neighborhood, but you got to help us. You got to help us a little bit. So, with that being said, folks, just a couple things to wrap up today. Number one, TV is not reality. Neither is Facebook. Neither is any other social media. The only reality is what you do, what you see, and what you hear, and with your own eyes. If you need help from us, be sure and let us know. But we're asking you to do your part as well. Put numbers on your house, secure your valuables, and I guarantee you, you'll see a drastic reduction in what happens, and also a very, what I guess would say, an increase in the feeling of security for your neighborhoods. And I think I said this a couple of weeks ago, if reality was being said, folks, would you rather see your house burglarized or your next door neighbor's house burglarized? Ideally, never one of them, neither one of them. We don't want anybody's house burglarized, but we're all a protector of our own first. So, until next week, folks, come by and see us at the police department. Drive safe. Remember the speed limit. Stay at least 4 miles below the speed limit. We're all happy. Have a good one, everybody. See you next week.
Arch Coons, the owner of ANC Firearms in Heidenhammer, Texas, is an avid gun enthusiast and enjoys helping all of his customers to find the gun that's perfect for them. With a large selection of pistols, rifles, and shotguns, finding the right gun becomes easy. Go to ANC Firearms, located at 5819 U.S. Highway 190 in Heidenhammer, or call them 254-983-4417. Pistols, rifles, shotguns, ammo, knives, and a whole lot more. ANC Firearms, 254-983-4417.
Aaron's Gun Shop and High Cap Adventures. If you've decided to carry a handgun for self-defense, you better know what you're doing. If you don't, you better learn fast. Not only fast, but thoroughly. Aaron's Gun Shop and High Cap Adventures fills the void between a Johnny wannabe and a person who has been properly trained in the proper handling and use of a firearm. Call me, Matt Beatros, at 254-697-4721 or email me at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com and set up a class or seminar to get you started on the road to proficiency with a firearm for self-defense. Go to our website, aaronsgunshop.com, and review the High Cap Adventures page. We have seminars to cover most forms of firearms training. Call 254-697-4721 or email me at aaronsgunshop@gmail.com to get more information on how to get started with your training. The time for games is over. Reality starts now. aaronsgunshop.com.
WRBSales.com takes pride in manufacturing the highest quality firearms gear. They use only the very best materials in their products. 1,000-denier Cordura nylon, ballistic nylon, and heavy-duty YKK zippers. All of their handmade, high-quality gear comes with a limited lifetime warranty and a complete satisfaction guarantee. And much of their gear has seen actual combat duty. WRBSales.com is your one-stop shop for all your firearms gear and accessories, and whether you're looking for maximum concealment, comfort, or a combination of both, WRB's products guarantee to deliver it even in the toughest of conditions. They know the industry inside and out, but more importantly, they know what you want. Explore from the best the industry has to offer only at WRBSales.com. That's WRBSales.com. If you're planning a party for a wedding, birthday, anniversary, corporate event, or just to have fun, and you plan to serve alcohol, you need a bartender. Aaron's High Cap Nightcaps bartending service is who you need to call. Aaron's High Cap Nightcaps provides a complete portable bartending service. When you provide adult beverages to your guests, you want them served fast, correctly, and with flair. Aaron's High Cap Nightcaps can do that for you. TABC certified, professional, and with a complete bar setup, Aaron's can help make your social event one to remember for a long time. Call Aaron's now at 254-482-0557 or email Aaron's at mail@aaronsnightcaps.com. Make Aaron's High Cap Nightcaps your first call and last call when you want a professional bartender for your next social or corporate event. Call 254-482-0557 or go to aaronsnightcaps.com. And that's powerful stuff.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Aaron's High Cap Adventure Radio Program. Again, it's October 8, 2016. We've got about 33 minutes left in the show. Now, in the show highlights, I mentioned to you that we're going to have a special guest on from Homeland Security. And let me give you a little history on how this happened. I was talking with the chief and asking the chief if he knew anybody who might be able to give some answers to some questions when it comes to preparedness and, you know, the population around here and things, the way they work and in conjunction with government as us out here living in our homes, doing our daily lives. And he gave me this thumbs up saying he does have somebody. And we have in studio now Jerry Mahemet. Did I say that correct, Jerry?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, Jerry, now, ladies and gentlemen, before I give him a formal introduction, I want to tell you, we're very blessed to have him on the show today. The phone number here is 254-697-6633. If you have any questions, give us a call. Make them proper questions. Be polite, courteous. Don't go crazy on me or I'll cut you off, okay? But seriously, if we got some questions, our guest might be able to answer it for us to give us better insight as to what we can possibly do, understand how things work. So with that, let me formally introduce Jerry Mahemet, who is now Cameron PD, used to work at Homeland Security for the Belton area. Is that correct?
Semi-correct. I used to work for the Central Texas Council of Governments, which is based in Belton. I was the Homeland Security and Criminal Justice Program Manager.
Okay, so you have access to a lot of information. I'm not going to Before we get started, why don't you give us a little history of who you are, how you got to this point so far, what you've done in your career, so people can get an idea of who they're listening to.
Well, I'm very privileged to be working here in Cameron now. I'm from this general area. I'm a Temple native. I graduated from the University of Mary Hardin Baylor, and did some time in the Air Force. I was an Air Force officer, did my active duty time, got out, worked for the Austin Police Department as a patrol officer and a corporal for some time, and then I did the Homeland Security and criminal justice job in Belton, and now I'm the criminal investigator for the Voice of Law Enforcement here in Cameron.
Good old Voice. We love... Explain to me how one hops from an officer into Homeland Security. What's the bridge? Is there a major difference in what you do? Because then when you explain that, then I want to start talking about Homeland Security and how it affects everybody.
Well, you need to understand that there are various levels within each. Making the jump, as you say, is really not that difficult depending on what level of Homeland Security emergency preparedness you make. There are actually college degrees out there that focus on emergency preparedness and Homeland Security. That's going to be more your administrators. That could be top government level jobs, so on and so forth. There are quite a few similarities between law enforcement, emergency services as a whole, and Homeland Security and emergency preparedness. The health career fields, a lot of folks don't realize. I myself didn't realize until I really started working into it. Sometimes it's just happenstance, and other times there are people that get on a direct career path, beginning with their education, and take it from there.
You made a comment about Council of Governments. Do you know how ominous that sounds? I'm very well aware of what it is. I've tried to get some people who were from Council of Government to come on. They were concerned that I was going to put pressure on them, and all I want to do is, like we're doing right now, is just ask questions and get some idea for knowledge. I know what Council of Governments is, but it sounds ominous. Explain how, you know, you got a whole bunch of people around here, governments, they need to work together so there's organization. Can you give an idea, just explain in generalities what a Council of Governments is?
No, absolutely. And I can understand that. It would sound ominous any day and age. When people hear the word government, there's a lot of people automatically go, uh-oh, you know, what's that about? The Council of Governments, anywhere, there are actually 23 councils of government within the state of Texas, and they exist in every state in the nation. And this was a federal program that was enacted well over 45 years ago. Councils of Governments are nonprofit organizations that represent regional government. They address everything from economic development to clean air to law enforcement, public safety, regional planning. If people are familiar in this area, especially with the HOP bus program, that is a Council of Governments program. If it were not for the Council of Governments and the regional planning aspect, there's a very distinct possibility that the HOP program, for instance, wouldn't be in existence. So
okay,
they're,
now
they're
I don't
behind the scenes.
I don't want to get off on this tangent, but I do want to ask one more question about it. How does one become a Council of Government? Is it an elected official, or are you just hired by a private organization?
No, it's a conglomerate, basically, sponsored through the regional governments. It includes the county judges, city officials, mayors, city council members, so on and so forth. To actually become a member of it, has to meet certain criteria that's met through the state and federal government guidelines, and that's a little beyond mine. I can tell you that basically.
That's interesting, though. It kind of gives everybody a basic idea of when they drive past in Belton, they see the Council of Governments, they get an idea of what's going on. So do your homework, everybody. Check it out, see what's going on. All right, let's get back to Homeland Security. I got questions, Jerry. I always got questions. Homeland Security came about, what, 9/11?
Roughly 9/11, yes. Presidential Directive 8, which was under President Bush at the time, was actually a bill that was signed into law and created what's now known as Homeland Security, the Department of Homeland Security.
With what you just said, let me ask my first question. Homeland Security locally, in a nutshell, what is it? What does it encompass? And what is its authority?
It's multifaceted. There's no one quick answer to that. What it encompasses is a variety of things. People think Homeland Security, generally, they think from a law enforcement perspective or federal government, soldiers, airmen, Marines, you know, the FBI. There's so much more to it than that. Our point of contact for Milam County is Ms. Susan Reinders, who is the Emergency Management Coordinator for Milam County. Every county has one, or in some cases, multiple emergency management coordinators who do just that. They coordinate various activities depending on what an emergency situation may be. So Homeland Security could be from a terrorist attack, which we generally see from the news, CNN, everybody associates that with Homeland Security. We're securing the homeland from an attack, from a militaristic standpoint. Homeland Security also involves, from the healthcare profession and the health department, pandemics. Could do with economic issues that may arise from, say, Hurricane Matthew, which is in the ocean right now. Any number of things that would constitute an emergency situation.
Aren't there other departments that do that? Like, what is Homeland Security? The umbrella that encompasses all the others?
Homeland Security is the umbrella. It is, actually. With Presidential Directive 8, that encompassed everything that previous to that point. It was right after 9/11. It was a few months after 9/11.
Well, I don't mean to interrupt, but name some of the things under the umbrella, some organizations under the umbrella, so we have a concept idea of what's under that big umbrella of Homeland Security.
Well, one that everybody's heard of from the federal level is FEMA.
FEMA.
Federal Emergency Management Agency. They're under that umbrella. From a law enforcement perspective, what used to be Border Patrol, it became ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that fell under the Homeland Security umbrella, where previously they were their own entity.
So if you're looking at an organizational chart, Homeland Security is the top box, mm-hmm. and then it splits down into all these different ones, ICE, FEMA, and anything else you can name here, and then it breaks off from there. So that's
right.
The president of security is Homeland Security.
The Homeland Security Director, and it goes all the way down, not only from a county level to your county emergency management coordinator, and generally the top person for the county will be the county judge. In this case, it's Judge Barkemeyer,
yes,
here in Milam County.
Yes, sir.
And then it can even devolve down into a city level. Emergency management coordinator, for instance, in our police department would be Chief Dixon. He is our emergency management coordinator.
Well, that would make sense, sure.
Right, which would handle.
And I'm assuming Chief is here with us still. I'm assuming Chief because the chief law enforcement officer is our sheriff, that you would go under him, I would assume. Is that correct?
Actually, I'd go under Susan Reinders, directly under her, because every department would branch out into a different area. The sheriff's department, the county, their actual emergency management coordinator, of course, would be Ms. Reinders. And then our city emergency management coordinator would go under Ms. Reinders, and I would go under, and I'm not real certain who the Cameron one is. I think it's our city manager. Mm-hmm. And from a logistical standpoint, then I would fall under him and then vice versa.
Okay, that's good stuff to know. I want to read another question here. It may touch on things you already mentioned, but let's just recap it too. I'm an active participant in society, and I've got three types of people that I've always categorized. You've got the informed. And there's the informed who sit on the couch and they just gather information for their own personal use, and they're inactive. They're useless, okay, except for themselves. Or there's the active informed person, who I am, and there's many out there who are, okay? Now, I've always had this sense that there is Homeland Security and then there's us, the civilian population, the citizen. Many times, I don't feel like we're on the same team. Meaning that many times the citizen feels left in the dark. Is there a reason for that, in your opinion?
Well, perception can be reality sometimes. I mean, there are certain things that require specialized training or a specialized chain of command, if you will, that the average citizen, even though they may want to be more involved, are not technically qualified to. It may actually cause more of a problem if they try to become involved. But there are positions that people can help with.
I can see that point. Go ahead. Keep on.
And one of the main ways is getting in touch with that local EMC, that emergency management coordinator. What I would suggest to people is get in touch with Ms. Reinders and say just that. I am an active member of the community. I care about my community. If we had an emergency situation, if we had something happen, be it a natural disaster, a terrorist attack, what can I do as an individual to help?
Isn't that where CERT comes in?
CERT has a role in that, yes.
And I apologize. I don't want to put you on the spot. CERT, what is that? The letters for CERT stand for?
Citizen Emergency Response Team.
Civilian Emergency Response Team.
Okay,
yes.
Very good. Okay.
And it is a group of volunteers that have training. No one is going to just feed anyone to the wolves and say, oh, you want to help, go forth and hand out water or whatever the case may be. You're going to be trained in it. But the first step is to go and say, I want to be an active part of it. CERT is one aspect, but not every community has a CERT team. So, and you don't have to have a CERT team in order to volunteer, in order to help. But the first step is going to the folks that are the officials in charge of it and saying, I want to know more. I want to help. How can we make this happen? Now, not everybody is going to know every single aspect of a program because, one, there's just not enough time. to educate everyone out there to those levels. That's why you have specialized positions and training that goes along with it. That's why you have a head of an organization and subordinates and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. There's not enough time, not enough resources to train everyone up to a particular level. Instant Command System is another. The world is rife with acronyms, and ICS is one. Instant Command System is a federal way of managing incidents. And it requires a certain set of steps and certain training on how to be an incident command manager. These take years of practice and study and practical usage. There are exercises that are conducted at the county level all the way up to the federal level. Practice, practice, practice. The federal government actually has for decades, and do our local governments anticipate and have plans for any number of disasters, even though the average citizen may not realize that, may not see it, and think, well, what's going to touch us here in Cameron, for instance? We'll say a hurricane. Most people would say, we're not going to feel the fallout from a hurricane. We're 300 miles from the coast.
Oh, so untrue.
Well, what they seem to forget sometimes is that we're in a major artery between a lot of cities, namely Dallas, Waco, and Houston. Highway 36, or 4th Street, as we know it here in town, is a major artery.
What was the hurricane down there? They evacuated Houston?
Oh, there's been a number of them. Andrew, Ike.
The one, anyway, one of those hurricanes, I can't remember the name. Literally, at the peak of the problem, people were overflowing onto my road and starting to camp out on the sides of the road. Had it happened one more day, you would have started getting very hungry people. Let me interject here. I got a million things going through my brain, okay? I am one of those people who think and are prepared and are constantly looking for better ways to do it. I know certain things. I know only so many people can handle so much. When you have a major situation happen, like that hurricane where everybody's coming up from Houston, it had happened one more day or day and a half more, resources to control that are going to be pushed to the limits. How do you get past that point? Because people who are in a position who are trained can only do so much. Then it falls on the civilian populace. I have this dread in me that a lot of people are not ready, okay? And I'm thinking to myself, in this town in Cameron, I look around and I say, what happens if something goes down? Is there a plan? What's the plan? What do you do? I'll give you an example. I see a fleet of school buses. Okay, if we got to get out of here, are we going to put those to use? I've never heard a plan like that. And maybe there is a plan that exists, but I don't know. And I'm one of those ones who are seeking. Can you imagine somebody who's not seeking has no clue?
Let me chime in on this just a minute. And most people don't understand this, but at least once a year, sometimes twice a year, Milam County has a full-blown tabletop disaster exercise. To give you an idea, the last 3 or 4 years, we've had one involving hurricane evacuation, tornadoes. We've had one involving a major train accident where there was hazardous materials. We've had an airplane crash. I did one just 2 years ago on an active shooter in a school. And these are things that are planned. What I would encourage citizens to do is to call Ms. Reinders and to find out when the next tabletop exercise, and come see how it's handled. And there are some plans in place, but we just don't make it well enough known. That's my opinion.
Chief, I can see on an airplane, I can see on these things where you have resources to do it, but on a mass scale like a hurricane, is there anything you can share, or is that some of those things you just can't do? It's too complex to share as to what actually, what's the plan? And Jerry, chime in on this. What goes on? What's the thought process? If you can, let the people know that, hey, there's a system in place and it's being used, and it's being used well. Even though you may not see it, it's there, and thank goodness that it is. Can you share that?
I'll just say quick, and I'll turn back to Jerry, because Jerry's the authority in this. But here in Cameron, for instance, we, and a lot of people don't know this, but we have a shelter, what is considered our shelter. There are like 100 plus cots available that can be brought out to use to set up for shelters. And it was close to being activated when the wasn't Hurricane Ike. It was the hurricane right after Ike, that when Houston was totally evacuated. But things like that are in place. I do think that sometimes we need to, and I don't want to say toot the horn, but they need to make it that knowledgeable what all we do have. You know, there's an old saying: if you don't know about it, it didn't happen. Or if you don't know about the information, how do you ever plan for it? we do have a lot of things like that, and I think that's something that's incumbent, and I'm as at fault as anybody. We need to let the people know that we are have evacuation routes. We have plans to have our disaster. We actually have a policy in our policy book that deals with impending disasters or disasters and how to handle that, the workforce and all that. So, Jerry, you know.
Actually, in answer to your question, there are two major plans out there that folks can look at. There are no secrets within anything involving this program. The last thing that anyone from the federal level on down wants to play is I've got a secret and not let the citizenry know. Those two plans are essentially, once again, I apologize for all the acronyms. I come from a military background. Everything is acronym related. It's THIRA. THIRA is the Threat and Hazard Identification and Risk Assessment Report. That is a statewide report. And everything that filters down filters back up as well. Everything from a local level that is being dictated from the federal government, here's how we believe you should handle certain emergencies, is also filtered back up from the local level saying this is how we intend to respond to particular disasters. For instance, and this could vary from geographic location to geographic location, because using the hurricane example, that's not exactly something that is so relevant to the South Central Texas area, because we don't have a major body of water that's going to experience a tropical storm within about 250 miles of us. So in this general area that we're in, seven county region that the Central Texas Council of Governments, for instance, is responsible for, that THIRA report addresses five major incidents. Three are major natural disasters. One is a man-made, and three is essentially a terrorist attack. The man-made would be considered like an accidental type of incident. What we focus on are things that have a possibility of happening or have already happened. There's a tornado. People forget that not too long ago, there's an F5 tornado that leveled the town of Jarrow. We plan for that. We plan for flash flooding, which is also very important, and wildfires. The Bastrop fire, less than an hour away from us to the south, all of these occurred. And because there were already plans in place, they didn't go as disastrous as they could have. Now, what we do, what all of us can do, is we learn and we put best practices into place. We use what did work from the plan and then identify what was broken or what could be improved upon, and we make the next plan for that. The man-made or accidental incidents, if you would, we generally based around a chemical spill, a toxic chemical spill, either from a derailed train or a truck, something like that, because we do have a lot of major arteries in terms of highways around this general area, I-35, Highway 77, Highway 79, so on and so forth. And then the fifth disaster would be a man-made, a terrorist attack, an active shooter. We know from Fort Hood recently, way back, people remember close to 20 years ago, a man called George Hennard ran his pickup truck into the Luby's restaurant in Killeen, Texas. That's been happening for some time. That was back in I want to say, like 95, something like that, 95, 96, around that time frame.
No, I think it was a little sooner than that because the law came into effect in 95, 96, and that was Graciata Hupp. Yes. Her parents.
93.
So 93, okay. Yeah.
93. So a lot of these things have already happened. We've already planned on them. That's THIRA. Those are things that we think may happen, have already happened, how we plan for them. Another local, more localized report is HMAP. HMAP is Hazard Mitigation Action Plan. That affects us directly here in Milam County because everybody remembers a little over a year ago, we had a major flooding event. We still have county roads and bridges that have not been repaired around here because we weren't quite prepared for it. Those were identified, some, and some were not, in that Hazard Mitigation Action Plan. It's just that how do we mitigate things from happening? We don't have a magic eight ball, but what do we do to anticipate what's going to happen, recover from it?
What about this? What you're saying is fine. It's great, and everybody's doing a fantastic job. But what if it's a continued event longer than normal? I'll give you an example. Jarrow comes, gets destroyed, wiped out, it's done, it's over, recovery. Flood. Floods came, boom, done, pretty much, except for roads, like you just said. An event happens, and then it's gone. What if it's an ongoing event? And it starts to maximize or push to the limit your guys' abilities because you've only got so many personnel. Right there is what I'm talking about. And I'm not this doom and gloomer. I'm one of those, I know it can happen. And I'm one of those, since I know it can happen, and I know it's not off the scale of probability or possibility, why not at least have a concept idea of what can be done to prepare for it? I think the main thing would be for personal readiness if you can maintain yourself and be your own little island at the moment so that government services don't have to come and save you, that's a lot of help to get off the system.
Absolutely.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, you need to be self-prepared. Now, there's some people who just can't do it. But let's say it's an ongoing event, longer than normal. What can the populace do? What would government services say to do? Is there anything out there recommended to do that you can add to this conversation?
The first and most important thing is for people to educate themselves. There are help manuals out there, if you will, quote-unquote help guides. You can go to everybody's in the electronic age. I dare you to find anyone who's living under a rock who doesn't have internet access anymore, and even if you don't. You can call up your local emergency management coordinator. You can go to preparingtexas.org, which is the state of Texas's emergency preparedness website. You can go to the Homeland Security or emergency preparedness, .org. If there's any kind of websites out there, call up, have materials mailed to you. These plans that I just told you about are perfectly open documents. There's no secrets out there. Read the plans. See what the plans have to say.
Kind of chiming in with that, I guess it was about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Quite honestly, as far as citizens are concerned, as far as self-protection, self-survival, I think every single person, I don't care who you are, needs to have at least a, and I don't want to use the word a bug out bag, but they need to have enough reparations put back in a box somewhere that they don't touch that could sustain them anywhere from 3 to 5 days. As a matter of fact, if people read the Cameron Herald this next Thursday's issue, I'm going to directly talk about that and about what people need to have in a kit to sustain themselves. And you're right. If it's a long sustained event, I'm not sure any city except the big cities who have limited budgets can handle it by themselves. We've got to have citizens to take the bulls by the horn and help protect themselves as far as self-reliance. And that's, you know, you got to have food, you got to have medication put back, things of that nature.
You know, Chief, last couple of weeks I've had recorded interviews from First Sergeant Matthew Kimmy talking about bug-out bags and all that kind of stuff. That's for when you just have to leave. But what you're addressing is, you know, holding tight, staying where you're at, you need to have supplies.
Right.
It doesn't take that much, really, to buy an extra can of beans when you're buying groceries and buy a case of CEFCO water. And CEFCO, you can pay me for the advertising on that one. Go to your local CEFCO and buy yourself a case of water for $4, okay? And just put it to the side. And if you need it, there it is, okay? Water, it's vital to have that. Okay, I'm going all over. And I'll tell you what, Chief, if you want, talk about that next Saturday.
Sure.
And that'll be a great topic to talk about. So be prepared for everybody. Next Saturday, Chief is going to talk about the preparedness issue of what you need to possibly have on hand. Okay, Jerry, I'm bouncing all over the place. I want your opinion on something here, okay? Government Code Section 418.184, Firearms. Government Code 418.003, sometimes referred to as the Katrina Law. I state this in my license to carry class all the time because things happen. Hurricanes happen. And in Louisiana, law enforcement was going to people in high and dry areas who were protecting themselves with firearms and getting guns confiscated, okay? So we here in Texas said, heck no, Perry signs the law, and we have Government Code 418-184. Let me read that to everybody. A peace officer who is acting in the lawful execution of the officer's official duties during a state of disaster may disarm an individual if the officer reasonably believes it's immediately necessary for the protection of the officer or another individual. I got absolutely no problems with that statement, and this is what I say in people in class. I say, look, if I'm a cop, and I come up to a situation, and it's heated, okay? And, you know, it's like, whoa, what's going on? I'm going to see you with a rifle, and I'm going to say, okay, you're cool, but look, I'll tell you what. Just, you know, let's put the gun over here. I'm going to unload it. When I leave, you can do whatever you want. But right now, I'm got. So I got no problem with that. But what happens? Do you fall into this area here where if something happens like that, guns can start getting confiscated? What does a person do if they know the government code, but maybe the officer doesn't? What would be your recommendation on that? If the officer wants to confiscate
the gun? I have an opinion on that, but for the moment, I'm going to say my opinion and then defer to the chief. Articulation is everything. There is a time and a place to fight the right fight. And what it takes is two aspects to this. It takes law-abiding citizens and it takes smart peace officers who know the law.
I agree.
And that is the honor and privilege of being law enforcement is we're not legal experts, but we are criminal law experts, and we have to be knowledgeable of all aspects of the law. And unfortunately, like in any profession in the world, be it someone working in the service industry, sanitation, law enforcement, we have people that are more adept at their knowledge and some that are not so much. The not so much ones cause the rest of us an issue. What I would say is this. If I were in a position where I would have to temporarily confiscate a weapon, I would make very certain that I had a legal right to do it, and I would try, as appropriate, to explain to someone why it was happening. Now, understandably, and I'm a gun guy, I think most police officers are, there was a time where I, in between police jobs, I was commissioned, I have a CHL, and yeah, it's a very hot topic to tell somebody, tell any American anything. It's in our DNA, if you will, that I'm going to confiscate something that belongs to you.
Especially when they're trying to defend themselves.
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely. A lot of it has to do with communication.
Okay, so I don't mean to interrupt. The law specifically states if they do nothing wrong, it's not used for evidence, it's not done in a criminal way, it must be given back. But if the officer, for some reason, doesn't do that, I know what the answer is. Comply with the officer, deal with it later. But that puts you in a predicament of vulnerability. I just wanted to bring that up because a lot of people don't know this code, 418.184. Now, being right sometimes isn't always profitable. If you confront an officer and say, well, listen here, man, government code says this, and the officer doesn't know it, well, you're going to get in a conflict, and you don't want that. The other thing is I'm always promoting that law enforcement has a penal code this freaking tall, they got to know, and license to carry has this thick. It's only about an inch thick, if that. So license to carry people are going to know very well their aspect of it, but an officer's got to know everything, may not know it, so you got to deal with them and educate and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, Chief, did you want to
And the key is an officer has to know what his job is, and he has to know what his limitations are, and that's education. If an officer says he needs to keep a gun for safekeeping while he's on a scene, I don't have a problem with an officer telling somebody that. But if there's no reason to keep that gun, he needs to give that gun back. You know, approach what you were talking about a while ago about, you know, what's always right is not always what's right. I mean, if it's kind of like you may know you're right with your wife or your significant other, but telling them that they're wrong, that doesn't really go real well. So sometimes the best thing an officer can do, in my opinion, is, number one, he's got to protect himself. If the situation is such a volatility, take the gun. But if you don't have a right to keep it, give that gun back right away. I mean, you know, it's like the controversy that's going on in Waco right now about the state fair, or the Heart of Texas Fair. You know, and I think the sheriff from McLennan County even came and addressed that. The law says one thing about open carry, and then the people that are running this fair have posted 30-06 signs. So, you know, what's always right is not always right.
Let me make an add-on comment to that. I know a handful of law enforcement officers in this general vicinity personally, and they know me, and they know I'll be there to cover their backs if it's necessary, and we have this very good working relationship. For other officers who don't know that, I would like them to know that, but the more officers out there that can make relationships and get a one-on-one thing with the civilian populace, man, you're going to have people watching your backs because they want to. It's just, you know, sometimes if there's this, like you were saying, Jerry, if you're not professional about it, you guys have a lot of responsibility. You get a lot of flack. But a guy who knows what he's doing, he's worth his medal, he's wearing a badge, he can win over tons of people just with the smallest of gestures. And so I recommend that on both sides. Law enforcement, do your best to do whatever you can to build public relationship. And the civilian populace out there, remember, they wear a badge and they're in harm's way at any second. And they've got to be on guard. So you have to take that into consideration. All right. With that, Jerry, we got a few minutes left. Ladies and gentlemen, the number here is 254-697-6633. If you have a question for the chief or Jerry or me or Trey or, you know, whatever, give us a call, 254-697-6633. And we'll be more than happy to put you on the air and take your question. But, Jerry, is there anything that I'm not covering that you might want to bring up in the final few minutes that we got here?
I think pretty much everything has been covered. To just a final comment on our last topic, absolutely. And something that I think should never be forgotten is this. Law enforcement is a calling. It is a profession. But we exist because of people. If it weren't for people calling 911, there would be no police departments. We work for you. We are here to support you. We need public support. I think we have, particularly in Cameron and in Milam County, tremendous police support. It takes us all working together, but I personally would like to thank all the citizens for supporting us. If there's ever a question, if you ever have an issue that you don't understand why an action was taken or you disagree with what the officer did, there's a time and a place to fight that fight. If an officer is acting incorrectly, or anyone for that matter, doing it during the incident that's occurring is not going to change the outcome at that point. There needs to be a time for cooler heads to prevail, and there's a proper way of going about it. But if you feel that something is incorrect, you have a question about a process or procedure, please call us. Please call the chief. Call me directly. And we'll be more than happy to explain what's going on. You may not agree with it, but we will explain it to you.
Chief, anything to add in the next 15 seconds?
He's exactly right. Call us if you have a question, but the side of the street's not the place to hold court.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, it was a pleasure. Guys, I appreciate Jerry. Thank you for coming on. Chief, it's always a pleasure. Trey, thanks for working the board. Is this a quick call? Do we have any time? Let's see what they got, if it's for us or not. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget we got a class, license to carry class at 2 o'clock. And anybody who wants to take a refresher, it's $40. Anybody for a new course, there's still room. It's $60. Go ahead, Aaron's Gun Shop in Cameron here, 10 minutes to 2. So until next week, keep your powder dry, and God bless.